You're listening to Around Comics, episode... Shit, I don't even know what episode this is anymore. 279? No, 280... Wait, it's been so long since we actually recorded an episode, I have no idea what... I'll pop that in later, don't worry about it.
281.5.
Is that where we're at? 281.5.
I think so.
All right. No, it's episode 5, because we rebooted everything. So it's episode... You're listening to Around Comics, episode 5. Around Comics, this is a new episode for the first week of June 2012. I'm Sal, and no, Chris and Tom are not here, but I do have two other guests on the show. First up, Mr. Braxton Harrison. Some of you may remember him from a little podcast we did for about a week called League of Nobodies.
That's my claim to fame, really.
Well,
League of Nobody is my claim to fame.
You're also a famous Southern private investigator.
Just a fan of Around Comics. That's a long-running fan. That's me.
Braxton, how are you, buddy?
Very good. Very good. Glad to be here.
And also with us is the writer and artist of Althina Voltaire, as well as the new artist of the Mark Waid written series from Boom Studios, Steed and Mrs. Peel. How are you, Steve?
I'm great. How are you?
Did I say your name, Steve Bryant? Did I actually say your name there?
I don't know. I just heard you say, how are you, Steve? And I've been trained to say I'm great.
Like a monkey. You just
pretty much. I'll be flinging feces later on tonight. Yeah, it'll be fun.
Steve Bryant, comic book artist and writer. You're like an auteur. You're a rare commodity in comics nowadays. Writing comics, drawing them, not that many guys do that anymore. It used to be a little more common, but
well, it's like the kid that couldn't get anybody to play with them. So that's pretty much how, you know, my career.
You learn how to do both when you
exactly.
can't get anyone to collaborate. Yeah, that's me.
Well, and that's, you know, it's interesting, this show kind of came together, not last minute, but, I mean, there wasn't a real big plan behind it, you know, big surprise there, but, you know, the two of you were available at the same time to record an episode, and I thought it would be kind of interesting because you guys are both in the same sort of, you know, same sort of place creatively,
I don't know. I think Steve has a little bit
more
than old Braxton here.
Oh, no. Don't be...
Well, I guess my point was
I don't have a completed work or anything, you know.
Right now, Braxton, you're working on a book. You're writing it and drawing it. You're working on Hit, which is the, you know, your comic that you're working on. And Steve, you've written and drawn Athena Voltaire and, you know, and so that's what I kind of meant, is you guys are similar but different. How's that sound?
Works
well,
for me.
Well, we wrote and drew our own properties. How's that? That's it.
Create our own property. Trying to create your own IP, your own brand, your own mega power in the comic book world. Is that about right?
That's it. That's me, anyway.
I don't know if I'd go for mega power. I'm just, you know, happy to be here. It's kind of like Ringo, you know?
Come on, give yourself a little credit. I know you're very self-effacing, Steve, but...
Well, no, I'm... I, yeah, it's... I know that, like, with my taste and my choice of subject matter, that I'm not going to be, you know, like a wizard top 10 artist or anything like that. So I'm not trying to be self-effacing when I say that. It's just, you know, mega power is beyond my scope. You know, I just want to, you know, be able to earn a living doing what I do.
That's always...
That's it.
Yeah, that would be a nice bonus to all the work. Well, before we get too far along, I do want to mention that this episode of Around Comics is sponsored by Discount Comic Book Service.
This month, DCB Service is offering a special discount on the new Dead World War of the Dead 5-issue mini from IDW. Each issue is available individually for 40% off the cover price. But if you order the special promo bundle of all 5 issues, you'll receive 50% off the cover price and a free sketch card. Also, the Zombie Apocalypse sale is still going on with extra discounts on various Image titles. So go visit dcbservice.com and get all the discounts you can handle.
So Discount Comic Book Service, go get your comics there because it would make me happy. Do either of you guys, have you ever used Discount or In-Stock Trade?
Oh, I use them all the time, and it makes Angela very happy when I use. Wait a minute. My comic store owner, and off mic or before we started recording, I was really giving him a lot of praise because he knows so much about publishing, though he's never published anything. And here I am touting Discount Comic Book Service. I don't think that would be very...
That's real nice. That's great. Just why don't you
stab him right in the back.
That's right. What has he ever done for you, the bastard?
No, I've...
Exactly.
Well, if I can sing DCBS praises, yeah, I've used them as well. And Cameron and Christina are awesome. And I've benefited from their scratch and dent sales many a time actually in the store. So big thumbs up.
Very good. Very good. All right. Now on to more important things, mostly what the hell are we going to talk about on this episode? Well, like I was sort of hinting to before, I thought you know, we could kind of talk about the trials and errors and you know sort of pratfalls of trying to produce your own comic book. And while in this day and age it's a lot easier than maybe it ever has been before, you know, Steve, you know, when did you first start with Athena Voltaire? When
we launched on the web in September of 2002.
So, and before, how long was it before it was published print? You know, in print.
4 years.
So 4 years. Tell us a little bit about that process. I mean, you know, like what was it like trying to get that book? And I assume that was your goal from the beginning, but maybe not.
Well, initially I started off just trying to, you know, standing in a portfolio review line, you know, trying to get work and stuff like that. And I realized somewhere along the way that instead of being the 15th guy with like Starman samples, you know, because when you call somebody up to follow up with an editor you talked with, you know, I'm the guy that did, you know, 4 pages of Starman. Oh, are you the one that put Solomon Grundy in it? No, it was the quiet scene with, you know, Jack and his dad. I don't know if I remember you.
That's pretty hilarious. But
like having your own character, I thought would be a good way of doing it. And I had like a dream project of what I wanted to do. So I just kind of took it from there, and I thought at the same time that I'll look for work, I'm going to do a pitch because I'd always wanted to do, you know, a 30s Aviatrix strip. So after about a year of not getting any pitches, a friend put me in touch with a site called Adventure Strips, which was part of the Modern Tales family of comic websites, web strips. So we just pitched it there, and the rest is
infamy.
History.
Yeah, I don't want to say history. Infamy, yeah.
And they say that all of the comic professionals say that to get known, the best thing you can do is to create your own comic and put it out there digitally,
yeah,
or print if you can, whatever.
I mean, that's definitely a common theme for most of them. Is, you know, the best way to show them your work is to show them your work, is to publish something. And you know, there was something you said, Steve, that was sort of interesting, is that you created your own work to show in a portfolio review, but nowadays they don't. I mean, Marvel and DC, at least. I don't know about like Boom and those, you know, or Dark Horse, but I don't think Marvel and DC will let you. Like, they won't look at stuff unless it's their characters, will they anymore? Does anybody know?
That I don't know.
I kind of think that's the case now, where any portfolio review stuff, they want to see their characters. They don't want to see like your own stuff, because then there's the issue of, hey, they, you know, they looked at my portfolio of my new character and then they stole it, kind of thing. You know, like almost for legal reasons, they don't want to.
No, I know they don't want to see pitches, but I don't know about yeah. characters.
No, maybe that's what
I heard. It was pitches and writing.
That would make more sense. I'm probably completely wrong. Thank you for.
We got to edit this out.
No, but no. They do encourage you to draw their characters, which it's always been kind of funny to me. It's like, oh yeah, you can draw Daredevil. Can you draw Batman?
Right.
But you know, I don't.
You got to pass it under the table when you get there. You pass the Batman under the table. Don't let them.
That sounds like a euphemism. Are you passing the Batman under the table?
It gives a whole new meaning to Bat-tussy, or
Hey,
pass Batman under the table.
What you had said? You know, what was it about an aviatrix in the 30s that, you know, drew you to that character? Why
Indiana
that?
Jones?
Well, obviously there's the, you know, Indiana Jones sort of correlation, but was there, you know, were you interested in, you know, female flyers?
Not so much. The aviation thing was like an afterthought, and it was an example of me being really stupid. Long story short, I really wanted to do something with a female lead, because I do like drawing women, and I try not to be, you know, exploitive. I try to, you know, kind of fall on the side of sexy without sexist.
Right.
You know, insert a this is Spinal Tap joke there. You know, what's the matter with being sexy?
Well, and I think at that time, like in 2002, I mean, it was very, like, it was, I don't want to say in vogue, but it was sort of like, it was hot to have female action characters, you know, at that time, I think, too, you know?
Yeah,
I
think
it wasn't a bad thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some of that. And so, you know, I wanted to draw a female lead, and I love the pulp stuff, because, you know, my favorite kinds of settings to draw are, you know, drippy jungles and ruins and, you know, massive ancient structures and stuff like that. So it kind of played to what I felt were my strengths. So, you know, I thought, well, what kind of situation could put her in that environment? And, you know, obviously archaeologist, but, you know, Indy's kind of already done that. So I thought, oh, pilot, you know, she can get other people in and out of scrapes like that without really thinking, I don't know jack or shit about aviation. and planes are hard to draw. Who knew? You know, so I kind of backed myself into a corner, but it's been really cool learning about this stuff. And,
have you read the Happy Bottom Writing Club?
No. What is that? Wait, is that the Pancho Barnes the prostitution ranch that she ran, right?
Yeah, it was at Edwards Air Force Base. It was the bar and little hotel that she ran. And it's, if you look at like The Right Stuff, the movie The Right Stuff.
Yeah.
That's the bar that all the pilots hang out in. That's the happy, and she's in, and like there's a very
that bar is like an old shack. We just watched that movie recently.
Yeah, I think it was more than that, like, because it was a restaurant and a hotel.
Let's be the back
room. I don't think they really, you know, presented it as well in the film as they did. I mean, I think they took some, but the book is actually really interesting, because she was a very pretty well known pilot and before she ran that club. At Edwards Air Force Base. That's the interesting thing. Like, it was, you know, it was right there, right? You know, I mean, it was literally on the military base during that time. So it's a really good book if you ever, if you ever want to.
It's like a commissary right there on the base.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, I wanted to ask you, did you create Athena Voltaire for the purpose to get work with Marvel or DC, or was that, I mean, initially in the beginning, you just wanted to create your own character, write a book, and, you know, I mean, what, when you were doing the portfolio reviews early on, was it to try and get work with Marvel and DC?
When I was doing the portfolio reviews, that was the case. But I came up with the character about 4 years before, maybe around 96. And I kept thinking, this is my dream project. So, you know, after I get established, this would be the kind of thing I'd want to do, quote unquote, when I'm good enough. And after standing in those lines long enough and going, well, nobody's remembering me now. Nobody's given me any work. So why don't I just do this and use it as my calling card to try to get publishing or to try to get freelance or whatever. And at least this way I'm spending time building something rather than going, I've done a DC sample and a Dark Horse sample. I need to do a Marvel sample, you know, because I feel like in some ways you're just that's so self-defeating. I'm not trying to diminish the people that actually have gotten work that way, but for me it just didn't click. I know some people get work that way, but yeah. I know a lot of people get work by producing a book, and you know, I see the benefits of both, but from my perspective, you know, doing four pages of Wolverine and then, you know, the next week looking through somebody else's book, buying a couple samples from a publisher that I don't follow just to try to get a handle on their characters. It wasn't productive for me.
It certainly seems that to create, I mean, if you're moving to a goal, to create your own book would be more fulfilling than to, you know, I don't do some fan fiction or what have you for Batman or Wolverine.
Yeah, no, unless you're drawing that famous Wolverine meets Freddie Mercury page, in which case that's high art.
That is high art.
That's just brilliant. But yeah, I mean, when you described it as fanfic, there is a certain element of that in putting together samples, and yeah, just. I obviously wasn't very good at it because, you know, I never got work that way. So I think
I don't think that it's that you're not good at it. I think that if anything, maybe it's a situation of just oversaturation or something. And, you know, there's a glut of artists, as there probably always have been.
And it seems like if you can produce a full book, you know, people obviously know that you're not going to flake because anyone can do four pages of samples and, you know, editors. Editors have every right to be leery of that because, you know, for every guy that you get that comes in based on brilliant samples, he probably deals with three flakes, who maybe aren't as good as their samples. You know, maybe they spent 2 months on four pages and then when they get, you know, a 22-page assignment with 6-week deadline, you know, they crap the bed. So, you know, it just makes more sense from my perspective, and what has worked for me has been, you know, I say what has worked for me with, you know, how low I am on the totem pole. But, you know, what's gotten me to that low level has been, you know, producing full book.
Well, you know, Steve, I mean, that's a... I mean, your accomplishments in comics is notwithstanding, and this is going to sound a little funny, but not necessarily are judged based on the sales of your book. I mean, being able to keep that book going and your perseverance and keeping Athena Voltaire alive and keeping...
Yeah.
I mean, that's an accomplishment, and you should never sell yourself short. What sells or what doesn't sell, or what is, you know, what art style or what characters or what type of book is going to be popular and what isn't is not something you can necessarily always judge, and you certainly can't necessarily try and create something with the intent of, hey, this is going to, you know, be a gigantic book, you never can tell. So, you know, I don't think you should necessarily just go, well, you know, I'm here in comics. There's a lot of things out of your control that create that. You know what I mean? Like, you should definitely, you know, feel pride in.
Well, if anything, I mean, it just goes to show you the medium that Steve is working in, where, and this is a testament to you, Steve. I mean, you have to stay focused on, you know, one topic, and that your character, you have to stay focused on it. You know, keep selling it, keep working on it, get a body of work that, you know, whenever someone does, you know, get interest in Steve Bryant, the artist, let's look at what he's got. Oh my God, look at we've got a couple volumes of this Athena Voltaire. And I mean, just from my own experience, you know, and at best I'm a hobbyist. I mean, let's face it. But I mean, it's hard to stay focused, right? I'm writing a book about a real life scenario private investigator. When, you know, and I've already gone through, you know, oh man, there's this 70s superhero action comic I'd like to do. Oh, there's this time travel thing I'd like to do. Oh, there's this, you know, high sci-fi thing that, you know, I thought of. But if I try to realize every single, you know, one of these notions, then, you know, I'm not going to ever have anything. So you really do have to stick with the horse you're moving forward on. And I think you are the poster boy. I'm sorry, poster man for doing that.
Well, he is sort of boyish. He has those boyish
looks.
He is
sort of boyish.
Yeah. Guys, I'm 46. Call me a boy. I'm thrilled. That's the nicest thing I've heard all day. But no, I wasn't fishing for a compliment as much as, you know, you always see people on Twitter that have their heads up so far up their own asses, giving out advice, and I'm like looking, and I'm like, I don't think you've actually published anything.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be saying, you know, here's how you do it, kids.
Right.
Because, you know, everybody has their own way in. God, man, I feel like breaking into comics is like defeating the Borg. You know, it's you got to find a new way every time.
Baby, you got the kind of love, don't wanna let go. I ain't gonna worry about it, baby. Boy, I feel like I better get on down there, oh yeah. Said that you love me, baby. Oh Lord! My baby left me all alone. Baby, got the kind of love, yeah. Please don't leave me to cry, baby. Please don't leave me to cry.
That's right. The bottom of the barrel. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking just for
under the barrel.
Speaking of the bottom of the barrel, let's talk to you a little bit, Mr. Harrison, about what you know, what you're working on and what your you know, experience so far has been working on this book.
Well, I've thought this, not to keep kissing on Steve's rear, but I've read a lot of posts from Steve, and I mean, if anyone is in the know as far as, you know, getting something published or you know, the wrong moves, the right moves, lessons learned, it's Steve. And I would pay him, you know, for a consultation to get something published, you know, when that time comes. But as for me, I'm not trying to work for Marvel or DC. I really don't have a story to tell or write or illustrate, for that matter. But, and like I said, I'm a hobbyist at best. But what I would like to do is publish or, you know, maybe digitally, maybe see it on the shelves one day, you know, my own short series, and then hopefully move to writing, and then having other artists come in, and, you know, we will come in and do another 3-issue run of the Private Investigator that I'm doing. But I'm the thing of it is I wish that comics were more, you could produce them easier and get them out, because I don't know that I can make a lateral career change in the comics. I mean, who knows what the future brings, you know, who knows what opportunities may come, but I mean, for right now, I'd like to, you know, just get something out there and just play in the world, you know, collaborate with other guys and, you know, write and then have someone else draw or what have you, and draw for somebody else.
Now you're working on your own book. What tell the listeners what it is.
Well, I mean, it's what it is a it's just a private eye tale of a guy in Atlanta, and he's without getting into the, you know, the pitch of it, which I'm really a long ways off from that, but it's basically a private eye, a real world setting. It's a quirky, it's not a hard-boiled detective tale. It's more of your quirky, zero effect, funky type of private investigator. I mean, there's murders and you know, it's not all humor, but it's just a he always comes out on top type of scenario. That will not be my pitch, by the way, if I ever go to it.
No, was fantastic.
Is it like a Carl Hiaasen type of vibe?
I'm not sure who that is.
He's one of the Florida mystery writers that, you know, does a lot of the kind of screwball type of stuff.
What kind of PI are you?
There's not a lot of whimsy in this story, but I'm going to look in. You have to text me that. That spelling of that crazy last name, but okay. I'll look into that. I'm trying to read a lot of PI fiction as I go.
Have you watched, and I think it's over now, but it was three good seasons of Bored to Death with Jason. Well, it's actually really funny. It's Jason Schwartzman.
Yeah.
And Ted Danson, right?
Ted Danson and Zach Galifianakis, and basically it's about a writer. He's a writer who wrote a really good first novel and now can't think of anything to write. And so to try and get his mind off of it and to do something with himself, he puts an ad in like Craigslist basically as a cheap but unlicensed private detective. And for like 3 years, it's him running around, and Ted Danson is his publisher, or was his publisher or something on it. And Zach Galifianakis is a comic book writer and artist who does his own book. And the three of them form this funny little group of sort of detectives, these wacky, really bad detectives. But it's really
funny. Is this something that propelled Zach Galifianakis into his career? Is this like one of his first?
No. I mean, it just ended last year. Was the third season, I think, and I think I think they canceled it after that. But it was really funny. I really enjoyed it, and it was very quirky. And I mean, it was more just about the three of them and just their funny interactions and stuff, but it was actually really good.
Well, as another selling point, and you know, this will probably make it into any pitch that I do if I were to go to Image or whatever when this is done, is you know, I am a real private investigator in Atlanta. I own an agency, so I want this to be quirky, whimsical, you know, but I'm trying to insert like real world, you know, how it actually is, the real boredom and some of the things that really happen on you know, like an insurance surveillance or what have you. And hopefully that will be a bit of a selling point, you know, whenever if I decide to put it on shelves, if I'm able to.
Oh, you will.
But, you know, well, you know, digital is always there, and who knows where it's going to be by the time I finish this. So.
Well, that's an interesting – let's talk a little bit about, you know, how that has changed the game for creator-owned stuff and for getting your own work online and in front of people. You know, obviously, Steve, you started out with Athena Voltaire being a web comic, but now you know there's plenty of opportunity to, you know, publish it yourself digitally or you know, through iTunes or through Amazon or different places like that. But also, you know, something like Kickstarter, which has become, it seems, a very you know, it's a breeding ground, it seems, for creator-owned comics now. You see a lot of success stories coming out of that for creators trying to get their own stuff. You know, digital, I don't think, has really found its feet yet, you know, with the big two, but it offers a perfect, you know, a gateway for creator-owned opportunities and for, you know, an easier way to get your book seen and even purchased, God forbid, by customers.
But does stating that you're going to release your book digitally, does that cheapen your Kickstarter pitch? Because I've read, you know, some people say, look, I'm not donating to anything unless they're looking to publish it, you know, in book form. Or
you're saying doing a Kickstarter so that you could put it out digitally?
Was that not what you were? There's a lot of cutting out. You know what? Your whole sentence just got completely blown out. That's what it was.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't. I don't know. I hear myself fine, so I can't tell when it's cutting out.
Well, I mean, that brings up an interesting point. I mean, if you were to try to publish something digitally, could you? You think you'd have a successful campaign with Kickstarter?
I don't know. That'd be kind of weird to. I mean, what are you raising the money for?
I think
the success stories of Kickstarter work when you're saying, look,
you buy
this book, yeah, and we're going to publish it. You know, it doesn't, it's not necessarily giving you the opportunity to go, hey, I'm going to quit my job for the next year and work on a comic book as long as you pay me X amount of dollars to do it. I think that's a harder sell, as much as, you know, it makes sense.
I never considered Kickstarter until our last conversation, Sal, about, and, you know, you really enlightened me as far as, you know, the options that I had with Kickstarter. But.
Well, like my thought on the Kickstarter stuff, first of all, never, ever, ever, ever make the selling point of your Kickstarter campaign, do this so I can blank. It sounds like the old Match Game TV show. Do this so I can blank.
Right.
It's all about whatever reward you're giving everyone.
Right.
And because David Gallagher did a Kickstarter thing for, I can't remember the name of it. It was the Something Boy. It was kind of a commandy kind of thing. And I think it was just strictly for digital, but he and his artist had a bunch of like prints and other original art and other things as incentives. And I think ultimately that's what it comes down to. If you can say, here's a really kick-ass hardcover. Because when I did the Athena Voltaire Kickstarter, I didn't know where I was going to be publishing. I didn't know when, you know, I would make it through somebody's publishing schedule. So, like, I did an exclusive hardcover of the material I had done up till that point.
Right.
And the other reward was a digital reward of the new stuff. And, you know, we did like 150% of our goal. So that, you can make it work as long as there are incentives that people like. But then, you know, you have Mark Andrew Smith, who's doing Sullivan Sluggers, the baseball graphic mm-hmm. novel.
Yeah, I supported yeah. it. I purchased one, I guess you could say.
Well, the Beat ran just a terrific op-ed piece that he had written, talking about through Kickstarter, you know, the creator as the new retailer, cutting out, you know, the distributor and cutting out the retailer themselves, and the new skill set that the creator needs to have, but also the possibilities open to them. And I mean, yeah, that's one way that it might go. You know, another way is just doing your book and releasing it digitally without, you know, worrying about print cost or finding a publisher. And, you know, webcomics still work. You know, look at Mike Norton with Battle Pug, and just pretty much everybody that Dark Horse is doing, the Bible Institute thing, Dr. McNinja, Axe Cop, all of the Perry Bible Fellowship was one of the Dark Horse mm-hmm. web collections. And then Axe Cop and Battle Pug and Dr. McNinja, all that stuff started on the web, and, you know, they're getting nice additions through Dark Horse. So I think there's a million ways to do this. You can take your book, you know, to Image, or you can publish it yourself. Oh, you know, it's kind of the wild, wild west right now, where we're trying to determine between, you know, what the new format's going to be, if it's going to be VHS or Betamax.
Right.
And, you know, it's scary, but it also means as long as you're retaining the rights,
you got options.
Yeah, you're only limited by your ambition.
Well, the nice thing is, you know, and you see it more and more, is that there's becoming this sort of symbiotic relationship between the big two, or, you know, the larger comic book publishers and creators, where you're seeing creators go, okay, well, I'm still want to go work for Marvel and DC for a while, and they're going to use me, you know, to sell books, but I'm going to use them to grow my name, and then I'm going to go yeah. and publish my own stuff and create my own, you know, my own IPs, you know, and I don't think it's I think it's a good thing that's happening, because you still are getting, you know, you're still getting good talent to work on popular books, but it's not the end of the road for creator-owned work. You know what I mean? That was one of my fears at one time of you know, you would see Marvel or DC, you know, just sort of grab, you know, all the hot young creators that were putting their own stuff out there. And then I was like, okay, well, that's great, but I don't know that I want to see Matt Fraction only work for Marvel. I'd like to see, you know, I liked his creator-owned stuff, and I'd like to see more of it.
Well, I agree with what you're saying, 50%, because it's a great system for writers. But, I mean, realistically speaking, you know, if an indie artist goes to Marvel or DC, you're probably not going to see him do a creator-owned thing. You know, that's pretty much the end of the line.
It's too sweet over there. The grass is too greener over there.
Well, and it, you know, I don't want to offend any full-time writers, but it does take more time to draw a comic than write a comic. It's a more time intensive process, you know? And, you know, the downside of that is, you know, if we didn't see artists
I don't know if that's necessarily, that's true on the basis of here's a Spider-Man story that's 22 pages long. You need to write it, but you're not, you know, I mean, okay, come up with the concept and the, you know, say 6-issue arc and write that, you know, and have that figured out. I mean, it's not like you're just sitting down and typing is the only thing that a writer does.
No, I agree with you, but, you know, the same perspective of the artist. Drawing the page is not the only thing they do. There's also the artist is looking for reference and stuff like that. You know, I don't think if you averaged it out over a single issue that it's going to take a writer you know, between 178 and 220 hours to write a comic. But that's an 8 to 10 hour day for a 22-page comic to pencil a book. You know, I don't think it's because you have guys, you know, that's over a month's worth of work. And you've got guys that are writing two or three books, you know, simultaneously over the course of a month.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they're any good. Well, I mean, really, you know, I mean, I'm serious. You know, you can have writers that push out tons of stuff. And I think that's one of the problems with a lot of mainstream comics is that they are just pushing out a lot of work and it's not necessarily any good. But I see your point, certainly, that once an artist goes to, you know, Marvel or DC and they're getting paid a nice page rate and they may have insurance and, you know, they're drawing Batman or whatever it is, it's going to be difficult for them to leave that to go do something. But I think those guys don't have that burning desire necessarily to do their own work anyway. So, you know what I mean? I think the guys that have the desire to do it are going to do it. And I also think the bigger, you know, the more, if they're smart at all and the more popular they are, the bigger their name is, the more they have to be sitting there going to themselves, why am I making all this money for them when I could be doing this for myself? I could make my own movie deal. I could make my own TV show, my own cartoon. You know what I mean? Like, I can't imagine that they're not thinking that. And I know for a fact there are guys that are thinking that. So I get you're certainly going to have guys that are just going to be happy and content and drawing, you know, whatever it is at Marvel and DC, and that's fine. But I don't think those guys would necessarily have that, you know, passion to do something anyway, regardless of their situation.
Yeah, well, I have talked to three Marvel exclusive artists that, you know, told me how much they envied the freedom that I have on Athena Voltaire, and that they, you know, with planning for their kids' college and stuff like that, they're like, I more than anything, I would like to do a blank book, you know, pick your favorite genre and not be drawing superheroes for Marvel, but I can't not do this. My wife would divorce me. So, you know, maybe those three guys are the anomaly, and everybody else that, you know, wants to break away from doing, you know, big two work already has, and those three guys are the only ones that are in that position. But, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is, I just think they can't, because, you know, you're busting ass working 60-hour weeks just to make your current deadlines. You don't have any extra time, you know, to work in the evening the way that writers do.
Well, see, I think that's where the state is for creator-owned creators, is they have to have, I mean, let's say I'm drawing the Hulk or writing the Hulk or whatever, and that takes all my day. Well, I have a different job, but I'm in the same boat. And, you know, me creating Hit is basically the time in between, you know, the time between raising two girls and running a business and taking out the trash or whatever. And I think everybody, you included, Steve, probably had that same, you just can't, you know, go to a cabin and rock Stephen King style with writing a book or whatever. It's just not the station we exist in. I don't know any.
I've contemplated, you know, I've contemplated one, committing like a mid-level, like white collar crime to get put into prison for a couple of years just to have the
and
solitary.
If you want to do a heist, let me know and we'll heist something together.
Cool. Either way, it works out. Either we rob a bank and we get away with it, or we get caught and we get put away and have the time to finally work on stuff.
Yeah.
You know, should work out, right? That's a good plan, I think.
Well, you're guaranteed to be in
caught. You can make some killer comics in prison.
Yeah, you definitely. 3, 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15. You get a 15-year. Imagine what you could do with like a 15-year stint in a, you know, minimum security prison. Or solitary confinement. You go into minimum security and you just take out the biggest, baddest dude, right? For day one, you go crazy and just like shank somebody, you get put into solitary. Just think of how much work you could get done in solitary confinement.
You'd have a hard time getting your reference, though.
Everything would just look like concrete walls.
Yeah.
And do pencils
be a lot count? Of good textures, though.
Do pencils count as sharp objects?
I would imagine they would. You could take an eye out with a pencil.
Well, that's true.
So you're drawing everything with a Sharpie.
Well, going back, all right, so the Kickstarter thing, I think it definitely is an interesting development. And, you know, I've already heard people talking about, like, the bubble. The Kickstarter bubble is, you know, imminent. Like, it's going to stop, like, people are going to stop giving money to projects that they like. Like, it's just, now's the time to get into Kickstarter because sooner or later it's going to end like it's MySpace or something, which seems a little weird to me because, I mean, charities exist for hundreds of years and...
Well, I mean, that the concept of crowdsourcing, I mean, which is what Kickstarter is, hopefully that won't go away. It seems to be, you know, a viable...
I would think you would see more Kickstarter type of places, you know what I mean?
A better Kickstarter or something.
Yeah.
Have either of you guys ever read, it was a blog post from maybe 5 years ago called The Theory of 1,000 True Fans?
I haven't read that. I've talked to a couple of people about it. I haven't read it myself, but yes, I am aware of that. And I think you're definitely seeing that sort of thing, but go ahead and tell us about it so that, you know, people that might not be familiar with it.
Well, the idea behind it is, if a creative entity can have what they call 1,000 quote-unquote true fans, people who over the course of 1 year will spend $100 on you, you'll make $100,000 over that year. Mm-hmm. For whatever good or service that you provide. So, you know, you break that down and it's like, what, $9.20 a month or something? So it's when you look at it like that, it becomes a little more realistic. And I think something like Kickstarter, you're starting to see some of this come to fruition. I don't know if there's going to be a bubble. I think maybe there will be a bubble for the people that don't provide the rewards.
Yeah, they don't deliver on their – yeah.
But, you know, I think if people keep getting, you know, a kick-ass hardcover signed by, you know, Jimmy Palmiotti or whatever, why not? You know?
Well, I wonder how prolific that is. I mean, how prevalent that is that people aren't delivering on what they're – I mean, is that happening a lot, do you think, in Kickstarter?
I don't know. I know I was really slow and I was really apologetic, but, you know, because we had some trouble with binding the hardcovers and just unforeseen stuff. So, you know, I'm hesitant to go back to the well until I finish, you know, the digital stuff that I want to get everybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've had a number of people say they would support it again. So I feel pretty good about that. But I've also had people say, you know, well, you're the only person that's actually delivered what they said they would. So, you know, I don't know what else they were pledging. Maybe they were pledging, you know, some guy that makes falafel or something. I don't know. But
hey, that guy's good.
But, you know, they might not have been pledging comic things is what I'm saying, because, you know, I know a lot of people that have gotten a lot of really terrific incentives out of these things.
I usually turn them down. You know, like if I donate more than the minimum or whatever, I usually turn down the incentives. I just figure, well, I'm not doing it because I want something extra out of it. I think it's a good project and I want it to see. I mean, I don't always do that, but a lot of times, you know, I will just kind of.
Man, Angela doesn't want me perusing Kickstarter when I've been boozing, man. Oof.
There's good stuff. Well, and that's the nice thing. Like the thing I like about Kickstarter as a consumer is that it's, you know, it allows me to just go, oh, well, this is something that isn't going to exist without my help, and I'm getting exactly what they're telling me. You know what I mean? Like, there's no marketing to it. There's no, you know, fluff. It's like this is exactly what you get. If you want to give this much, you get this. If you want to give this much, you get this. If you want to get, you know what I mean? And it's straightforward, and I know exactly what it's going to be, and it's through Amazon, and it works, and I'm, you know, and I get to find new and interesting things, and that's really, I think, the great thing about it is that, like a book like what's the baseball one again? I'm sorry, Sullivan Sluggers.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that one, it's like, would that book even get published without Kickstarter? Would it even find a home, you know, without something like Kickstarter? You know, would these books even have a chance? Because, you know, as you know, Steve, as well as anybody, like, keeping that thing going until you can find somebody that believes in it can be costly and, you know, and all, you know, consuming. And I'm sure there were more than one time that you thought about just going, you know, screw this, it ain't worth it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, trying to find reviewers, trying to find, you know, get in touch with retailers, all, you know, hell, trying to find publishers that, you know, when you're walking away, don't actually throw the pitch in the trash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's plenty of that. It's discouraging at every step. But by the same token, you know, 2012 is much better than, you know, the 2002 when I started, or, you know, the earlier days of web comics. There are people that were doing it, you know, well before I was, and. You know, you didn't have social networking the way that you do now. You know, you didn't have Tumblr and Twitter and Facebook and everything like that. You had message boards, and that was about the extent of it. So I think you can really reach a lot of people. You can network on these platforms with publishers or potential readers or Kickstarter backers or, you know, everything, reviewers, all that. And it's a lot more accessible, and I think it's just as time consuming, but I think you can reach a lot more people. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's part of the sort of modern concept of being a comic book creator is you're not just writing or drawing or writing and drawing a comic book any longer. You're marketing it. You're selling it directly to the public. You have to be the one pushing it. You know, and you have to know how to use all of these services in order to connect to those potential 1,000 fans, you know, real fans, and get them to buy it. It's no longer, I mean, and it always was, I guess, to some degree, certainly, it's just on a bigger scale with, you know, the potential now to go, well, there's, you know, there's a real possibility that this could succeed and turn into a enough of a monetary reward to sustain it as a career. You know, like it used to be, well, if I don't get it published, if I don't find a publisher to believe in it and put it out and then it sells, I can't do this. You know what I mean? Or
right.
If I don't get work at Marvel or DC, I can't do this. But now there's the real potential of going, well, hey, you know, you can make enough money on a Kickstarter, or, you know, to potentially keep you going for the next year at least, you know, to do the next book and that kind of thing. And I think that's the really exciting potential of it for creators to see it, you know, as
well. As if that. Anything, it's also just it's a bit of publication. You know, I mean, Kickstarter is pretty popular. A lot of people go there, filter there, and, you know, it's just one more place that, of course, I guess they can also see how bad you're failing at, you know, trying to meet your goals, but.
Right.
Well, Sal, Steve and I both talked about, you know, our creative endeavors the focus has been, or Steve and I have kind of shared the spotlight a little bit, Sal. I wanted to hear, I mean, you're a creative person yourself, you've got a blog out, you're a rather good artist yourself. What are your plans on creator-owned or
You know, I go back and forth with stuff. I mean, I have some projects in various states of progress. I have 8 pages, a little 8-page story that I wrote, that is drawn, that I need to color, and then get out somewhere. Originally I had a place for it, but I'm not sure if that place is still there because it ended up taking a while to produce, a lot longer than I thought.
But it's a pitch, though. I mean, it's not.
No. This is an 8-page self-contained story. This one was something that could have been. There could have been more to it, but it was a. It was an 8-page self-contained story. And then I have a pitch that I worked on with Will Pfeiffer. Him and I came up with something that we have a pitch for, and we're still looking for an artist to draw that pitch and then try and, you know, find a publisher or do something with it. I really like that one. Will and I worked on that for a while, and I think it has a lot of potential. What the hell was that? Did Steve fall?
It wasn't me.
Did you fall asleep?
No.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of rattling of the old ice cubes on your end there, Steve. We, you know.
You're like Dean Martin over there with the ice cubes. Like, yeah.
Well, no, I think it's this damn cord of mine is really long, and anytime I turn, it like bumps against my table. So, yuck. Now here's the ice cubes.
Now they don't
see.
Sound
that's pretty
like
quiet.
There's
it's
liquid.
Full. That's
there's
full,
liquid
though.
In there now.
Yeah.
Then drain the other one.
But yeah, and then I have something else I'm working on with someone that I think will be awesome, but I can't really say anything about that one yet. But that one probably has the most. It's not a comic book per se, but it's comic related, and it's with a pretty well known comic person, and I think it has a ton of potential. But right now that is you know. And my biggest problem is I don't know what the hell I want to be. Like, one day I want to write stuff, and I have ideas constantly. I mean, I have, you know, Braxton, you know, I have idea after idea for stories, but I have very little time to sit down and be a writer. And that's kind of even an excuse. Like, I have very little ability to sit down and be a writer. I can write. I just can't.
You can almost switch into.
What? Say that again?
I'm cutting it out. You there?
Yeah, I can hear you.
You can almost. We can almost switch into like a writer's workshop. You know, from the topics we were talking about. I mean, I think the key is to just stick with something, you know, through the ebbs and flows of the highs and lows of inspiration. You know, you want to work on something, and then you don't feel compelled to work on it.
I'm very self-destructive. I mean, I tend to fear trying a bit. And I then find things to distract me, so I don't actually have to try. But I don't know. That's deep psychological issues based on, you know, that needs years and years of therapy to try and figure out, and I can't afford that. So, but then, like, I want to be a better artist too. Like, I love to draw, and I've gotten into digital painting, and you know, you've seen some of my illustrative stuff, and I also want to spend more time drawing and, you know, doing that kind of thing. So it's, you know, in the meantime, I have 2 kids that I coach in multiple sports. I have a full-time job and a house that's falling apart, and you know what I mean? So it's like and a podcast that, you know, now I'm trying to revive, and I don't know. I think one of those people that really, really wants to make stuff. And I've never really, I'm sort of like you in the sense that I've never really had the burning desire to to do anything for Marvel or DC. I don't have a story for Spider-Man or Batman or any of those characters. As much as I like all those characters and love reading the stories, I've never really thought about writing anything for them. But I have ideas for stories of other stuff all the time that I would love to produce. My problem is I need to be like Stan Lee, where I just find really talented artists to take my idea and create. I just need a Jack Kirby. So if anybody knows of a Jack Kirby laying around that I can take advantage of.
They're on every corner, really.
Yeah, I think so. They're all, you swing a dead cat at a Comic-Con, you find a Jack Kirby. But yeah, I don't know. I go back and forth from, you know, one day I'm writing and then the next day I want to draw more and the next day I have four other projects that I want to do. So, but I do feel like over the last year or so I have made some progress and I'm getting closer and closer to actually maybe getting some stuff done. So, we'll see.
Well, Steve, what can you say as far as advice for Sal and myself on getting something out or one project out? Have you not had any inspiration to do something other than Athena Voltaire?
Oh God, yeah. I've got I've got a project that I've written that June Bob Kim is going to be drawing. Another one with a penciler named Eric Roman and Mark Stegbauer, the inker. And those guys are just starting to work on stuff on that. I've got a pitch that Jason Millay, who colored some of the Athena stuff, he's a Chicago guy, is going to be drawing. So, yeah, I've got like a million things at all times, too. And it's tough, but at one point I just kind of told myself the only unpaid thing I'm going to draw is going to be Athena Voltaire until, you know, if I go through Dark Horse and it fails horribly, then I'm going to, you know, do another thing I'm going to write and draw. But if, you know, if God willing, it's successful, I have no problem with making that, you know, the only thing I write and draw and then just writing a bunch of other stuff. So I learned a long time ago that I can't draw everything that I come up with. So,
yeah,
it's a bear though to be able to try to find the focus, because yeah, I think we can all like sabotage ourselves. You know, I know that sometimes I'm like an alien abduction victim. I swear I look at the clock and I'm like, I've got lost time. You know, yeah. I have to check to see if I've been probed. And thankfully it's always been no. But suddenly I'm turning into Jake Johansson. It's really tough because I think all creative people, you know, there's the whole thing of trying to find the moment when you're ready to work on stuff and inspiration. This comes around to like my favorite quote ever. It's a Jack London quote and it says, you can't wait for inspiration. You have to go after it with a club. And I think that just kind of says everything about, you know, it's,
well, someone else had said, I heard it on a podcast. It was a writer's podcast, and someone was describing the inspiration for writing. And there was an app on my iPhone that I tried to use called Evernote or something to try to catch. Oh, this would work, and you know, you would record it or write it or whatever really quickly. But they were describing inspiration or writer's inspiration or the thought or feeling of getting something out or you know, something that would be really good or click with whatever you're doing as something that's going to pass. I mean, it's not like you can, oh, I'll remember that for the next time I sit down and you know, write. You can't do it like that because it's fleeting and you have to, you know, take it while it's there, as it were. And that's the same thing from that quote, I guess. It's
well, yeah, I mean, the initial idea when you've got it, you know, sketch it or write it down or whatever. But at one point, you can't wait to recapture that lightning in the bottle you had when you originally thought of it. You know, if you're going back through your notebook or your sketchbook, at one time it does become almost a technical process of saying, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to produce. And, you know, I think getting over that initial stage fright is the best part, because, you know, if you don't like what you write, you do a save as, you come back and you take another pass. If you don't like what you're drawing, you know, you've got an eraser, you've got Command Z on your computer, you know, you can do all these things. It's just that fear of taking that first step, which is pretty ridiculous, because, you know, you're not committed to anything. You're not married to this idea. Just take that first step, which sounds easier to say than do.
What's your processes for, you know, splitting up the time between writing and drawing the books that you're working on?
You want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. Well, writing is something that's done fairly. I think I wrote this on my blog once, that I only write when I'm, you know, in the zone, or I'm really inspired. We're on vacation or something, or I'm jogging or what have you, and that's when I do my writing around that period. Sometimes, you know, I've found that, you know, the bulk of the writing or concepts and ideas come at those moments, but there's a lot of, you know, stolen hours here and there to try to, you know, patch holes in your script or what have you. And those moments are kind of mechanical. They're a little more academic, and the drawing is kind of like that, where, you know, I do really chicken scratchy loose thumbnails, and every artist can say this very same thing. Those thumbnails represent, oh, this is the perfect scene. This is the shot that, you know, is carrying this narrative, and it's all right here. But the actual drawing, for the most part, it's clock in time. I mean, you know, there's not a lot of create. Well, there is, but I don't have to ride the beautiful unicorn of inspiration to do it. It's just, you know, you got to draw this car right here.
You should club that beautiful unicorn of inspiration, right, Steve?
No doubt, man.
Yes.
What about
like a
you?
Baby seal.
What about you? I mean, you have more, you know, multiple things going on, but, you know, how do you sort of divide your time between writing and drawing?
Well, most of the writing is kind of in the can now. You know, I finished the stuff up for June, and now he's just working away on it and stuff like that. You know, I've got the Athena scripts done. Now I'm just kind of working my way through it art wise. But like when I sit down to do it, I read the, J. Michael Straczynski book, The Complete Book of Script Writing. This was back when, like, Babylon 5 was just coming out, and he was like a story editor for Murder, She Wrote. And he wrote this terrific book on script writing before he ever did comic stuff. Mm-hmm. And he talks in there about, like, laying out the scenes of the book on 3x5 index cards. I mean, the scenes of your script, and seeing if, you know, how you want to arrange them and stuff like that. And I never did that, but I pretty much, like, I'll do my basic plot, and, you know, I'll do rough page breakdowns on, you know, I usually do it with a spread. So it's like page one, then 2, 3, I want this to happen. 4, 5, I want this to happen, you know, stuff like that. And then I'll open up a Word document and just do 22 pages with like a sentence saying what's going to happen on each page. And then I just start filling it in as I go.
Genuinely, I mean, where do you start with the plot as far as like, okay, do you come up with an ending first? Do you just sort of go, okay, I have a couple of scenes that I want to work out and the ending will come, or, you know, how, 'cause a lot of times I have the issue of sort of a winding road that ends up spiderwebbing and getting a bit, you know, too bulky for me to handle at some point. And a lot of times that ends in a lot of frustration and a lot of the failure in completing stuff, you know, because I just can't seem to find the end of it. You know, I can't, you know, navigate through
this
jungle.
That's the first thing that I learned before Hit. I was doing another project, and it's, you know, it's my magnum opus if I ever get to it, but it's a great story, but it's too long. And I mean, especially with comics, it's all about brevity and saying as well. I mean, just, you know, like Steve was saying, it's so much to draw it. It's so much work to produce that you have to truncate it as much as possible.
Well, are you saying, Sal, that you kind of like get a little lost when you're doing it?
I just tend to, you know, I'll start with an idea, with a concept of a story, and then work on characters a bit, and then start going with the story for, you know, moving the plot along. And before you know it, I have sort of this, you know, gigantic story that is, you know, just completely gets out of control, and I don't know where it's going. I don't have an end. You know what I mean? I don't have an ending for it, because now it's like, it's too big. It's too, you know, I tend to do that a lot. Like, I end up with these gigantic concepts, or not gigantic concept, but a concept that turns into a larger story with no light at the end of the tunnel, it seems like.
Well, I mean, do you ever think about format while you're doing it?
Constantly, I do, but that is, you know, I guess.
I have to look at, I mean, while I'm writing, I'm pretty soon into the process, I'm starting to think about the end, or, you know, how does this wrap up? And I guess that's something I've learned to do, because
I mean, I've tried,
I've been there where you're at, where you really just, you have all this stuff to say and you want to include it, and it keeps furthering the story and you can't end it.
I guess, I've tried every type of formatting, you know, sort of process that I could find. And they rarely help, you know what I mean? Like, they just, I don't know. It's hard to explain. It's just sort of, a lot of times the stories tend to start to unravel a bit, and I have a hard time bringing them back in under control. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe you might want to bring in an editor earlier on. You know, just a friend. You know, someone else that writes. You could. Here I'm going to speak for Will and say you could you know, have him take a look at it and write notes. Before you get too far down the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like, one of my favorite, like, stories about comic book editing, I can't remember which Hellboy story it was, but like, Mignola had a completely different end of, I don't know if it was Wake the Devil.
He had John Byrne, do the
first.
Yeah, but like, it was either Wake the Devil or maybe it was Almost Colossus, where there was just a completely different ending to it that, you know, Scott Alley kind of directed him away from. You know, I mean, an editor can be a really good sounding board. It's not like you're bringing in a co-writer; you're just kind of bringing in someone to kind of fence out the land while you're writing, mm-hmm. so that, you know, you don't go too far off the reservation. How many metaphors can I throw in there?
Just start mixing them.
Oh, I will.
Steve, let me ask you this. So,
unicorns. What?
When you, in writing Athena Voltaire, have you found that to, like you have your story, you have these things that's going to happen, do you start trying to whittle things away, knowing that I'm going to have to draw all this, you know, stuff here, so let me start, you know, hopping to this.
Let me kill this horse. This horse is not coming in this scene.
Frequently, Steve, the artist is saying really rude things about Steve, the writer. They don't play nicely, but you know, it's one of those things where I shouldn't say that because aside from making her an aviatrix, I do tend to write to my strengths. And when it is something that isn't one of my strengths, I'm invested in the story enough to where I go, well, you know, I really don't want to draw, you know, three scenes of the Nazis sitting around an office, but you know, you got to eat your vegetables before you have your dessert, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now, like when I'm fleshing the stories out though, I'll start with an ending or, you know, a basic plot there. I'll have random scraps. I'll have like some dialogue in my head that I really like that I'll put on paper and I'll remember, you know, I've got this elsewhere and I'll copy and paste it. So it's not as linear as I made it sound when I initially pointed that out, because there are, you know, fragments that will just get thrown onto that page and you kind of build around it, when writing it. I don't know.
I think one of my problems is that I expect it to be better than it is. Like I have a hard time just sort of going, well, it's going to be okay, you know, but I really want it to be amazing. And you know, it's rarely.
Well, if you keep doing that, then you'll usually the problem with that is you'll keep making changes as you go and you never get anything done. At least that's what I would do.
Well,
and the good news is, Sal, that we're all natural storytellers. And I was just listening to the Paper Wings podcast, and they had this guy, Brian McDonald, on. And I urge you guys to go, you know, download that as soon as possible and listen to it. I think he's a script writer or something. He's written a book on script writing or storytelling. But he says, according to him, we're all natural storytellers. But, you know, like when you get into a conversation with somebody, I mean, you have this intuitive sense to whatever you're saying, you got to have an ending to it. You got to have a point. So we all have this innate ability to tell a story. And that's why a lot of when you're writing, even if you don't have this, you know, I don't have a degree I never took any classes or anything, but you can rely on your own born intuition on crafting a story and it be cohesive enough and enjoyable. Sometimes you just got to rely on what feels right. Does this feel like I'm droning on with this part of it?
Yes, it sort of does.
So I'm not a good storyteller. Oh my god.
Well, I feel that way about myself though. Like I'm a terrible storyteller, so that doesn't help at all.
Doesn't help.
I think I'm a decent writer. I'm a terrible storyteller when I'm talking to someone. I can't.
No, you're not. You're fine.
All right. Well, let's shift gears a little bit here. I wanted to talk to Steve about also, you know, a couple of things. A couple of things that have happened with you recently. Going back to Athena Voltaire and the fact that Dark Horse is now. I'm not sure how you describe. How do you describe? They're publishing it. They're co-producing it. I don't know what the. How are we describing it?
I am publishing through Sequential Pulp, which is an imprint of Dark Horse. So does that work?
Yeah, but what does that mean?
The Sequential Pulp guys have a deal where they can package and put together books that Dark Horse publishes. And you know, I was speaking with them, and we have a lot of similar sensibilities. So, you know, they invited me on board. So it's a Dark Horse book. It's in the Dark Horse part of the catalog. It's just this brand of this subset of books that all have, you know, similar pulp-like sensibilities.
Now, do you retain like editorial control of the books? Is there, you know, are there other creators that are going to be involved in it at all? Is it still the same? You know, you're doing it, you know, nuts to bolts.
Soup
to nuts. How do you say that?
Soup to nuts. I've always, you know, packaged the books myself, and that was one of the first things that I asked Michael Hudson of Sequential Pulp. And absolutely, I can do all of that. However, you know, the Dark Horse editor will be looking at it, of course, and that's only right because it's got their logo on the front.
Sure, sure.
You know, if...
Listen, Steve, we're going to have to take out... You have 75 Wangs in this book. We have to remove at least half of them.
Well, yeah, you know, if there's a storyline where you know, I have Athena Voltaire say, you know, instead of punching Nazis, maybe I'll join them. You know, who the hell's going to want to publish that? I wouldn't want to read that.
Right.
So, you know, obviously there has to be some level of editorial control. And no, that was never a possible storyline. But...
Well, it could have been double agent kind of thing, you know.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, we'll fool the reader. But
she's
you
a
know,
Nazi.
Everything's been cool so far. You know, I gave my target dates to Sequential Pulp, and they conveyed them to Dark Horse. So I don't know what the process is going to be when I turn a book in. You know, how long before it gets on the schedule? I don't know if Dark Horse tentatively plans for, you know, the schedule that Sequential gives them, or if they just slot it in when they get a completed book. I don't know how any of that works. It's all kind of above my pay grade, but you know, I'm just happy to be there.
Yeah,
just happy to be here. Just happy. Well, the other thing I'm sure you're happy about is you have been named as the artist on the ongoing series of Steed and Mrs. Peel from Boom Studios with Mark Wade. Is that correct? Am I correct in all that information?
Yes.
Tell us about Steel and Mrs. Peel. Wait, Steed and Mrs. Peel, right? That's Steed and Mrs. Peel.
Right. You don't want to say Steel and Mrs. Peed.
No, that's not. that's a whole different book. That's
you were going down that path.
Weird manga, I think, that Vince B reads.
Well, yeah, it's based on the 1960s TV show The Avengers, with you know, a very proper agent, John Steed, and his assistant, Mrs. Emma Peel, who, you know, he's the proper guy with like the you know, the fancy trick umbrella
bowler
that's
hat.
Also a weapon, yeah, yep. Bowler hat, and she's, you know, this cat suited Renaissance woman that is skilled in many, you know, martial arts and art and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's kind of like the British moonlighting, I guess, before there was moonlighting. So, you know, there's like an underlying romantic tension there. The TV show was like during the spy era of the 60s. So, you know, you've got a lot of the spy elements, but it has very tongue in cheek moments, doesn't take itself too seriously, wildly inventive. So it's a lot of fun. And, you know, seeing how Mark is translating that over to comics, it's challenging. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm excited.
Now I have to admit, I'm not terribly familiar with the Avengers TV show.
I always thought it was kind of like the old Batman. I mean, as far as the gimmick and campiness of it back then, is that true?
Yeah, I'd say it's somewhere in between. Wow, what was it? Was that me?
No,
you guys hear that?
Okay. It may have been me. I'm having all kind of phone problems over here, Skype problems.
But yeah, I'd say it has some elements similar to Batman, and I'd say maybe. You know, maybe
I should say the TV show Batman, not the comic.
And you know, maybe I'm just saying this because it's a UK production, but it seems to have kind of the same sense of whimsy as like Doctor Who. You know, the shows are nothing alike, but there's a sense that the writers aren't self-conscious about what they're doing, that they don't mind having a laugh or embracing the absurdity of the situation, which I think we don't get as much of in American productions.
Hmm. We take our shit too seriously.
I'm not saying too seriously because, you know, turn on Mad Men and I'm there. Turn on Game of Thrones, I'm there. So,
right.
You know, but I think it is a different sensibility, and there's a real charm to it. And so, like I said, Mark has conveyed it in a few of the visual elements that he asks for. And, you know, I hope I can deliver to everybody's satisfaction because it could be a lot of fun. It should be. If it isn't, then I'm screwing the pooch, you know.
Now, visually, are the characters, are they, I mean, are you drawing them like the TV show, the actors from the TV show?
Yeah. Yeah, they have the rights to the two lead actors, so you know I my likenesses have to be approved by the licensor, so you know I don't know how much back and forth there will be with that. I've done licensed stuff before, so I hope that you know I don't drop the ball too much, and it is taking place in the 60s, which will be a lot of fun.
But there's lots of reference you have to use.
Yeah.
I mean, tons.
Well, yeah, but I love period pieces because you can tell so much about an environment by, you know, the way the suits the people are wearing or
the cars or
yeah, the cars and all that stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's a bitch to draw, and there's certainly you know, a lot of stuff to get right and have to reference and research, but you know, if you can really sell it with that kind of accuracy, I feel like then the period that the book takes place in becomes almost like another character.
Yeah.
How did that come about? I mean, how'd you end up on that book?
I'd been sending samples for a couple of years. I'd tried out for some other books that they went a different direction in. And the last batch of samples I sent out, you know, I got an email back from Matt, the editor-in-chief, and he said, hey, I think I have a book that, you know, you might be appropriate for. And he gave me the rundown, and I worked up the likenesses, and they liked those enough to have me do a sample page. And like a day after I did the sample page, they said, okay, great. You know, Mark's working on the script. Do you want to do this for, you know, X dollars and let's go. So it was the most painless thing I've ever had happen work-wise. And, you know, I've had a couple of years where I've had other things fall through, you know, sometimes before it gets started, sometimes, you know, a month into the project. So this was too easy, so I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop, but apparently nothing did. So, you know, knock on wood.
Watch your back.
Exactly.
No, that should be cool. I mean, I think that's a really, you know, that, you know, that's a very good fit for you.
I do think it's a good fit for you, yeah.
But well, has Suntress, has he, like, been sending you emails constantly about, you know, what not to screw up or... You know, like little trivia tidbits about the Avengers. There's a pretty passionate following of Avengers fans, isn't there? I mean,
oh yeah. I mean, I saw the when the announcement was made on Bleeding Cool. You know, like the comment section in the back, there were all kinds of people just, you know, ticked off that there wasn't a British writer on it. You know, because apparently Mark Waid's 20 years of experience, you know, don't really count for anything. but yeah, I thought that was kind of funny because I'm like, well, you know, as far as I know, Mark Miller's not really American. And a lot of people liked his take on Cap in the Ultimates, right?
Yeah.
You know.
It doesn't, I mean, yeah.
What you got to do is just instead of having a hot dog or burger, they're eating fish and chips. I mean, come on.
Well, no, I've already made this joke once. I'm going to recast everything. It's going to be like Don Draper as John Steed, and Mrs. Peel's going to be Joan Holloway.
Nice.
Christina Hendricks. So, yeah, I scared like half a dozen Brits right there.
How have you been liking this season of Mad Men?
Good.
Oh, yeah. The last season I wasn't crazy about, but this season has been fantastic and just gut-wrenching, and so many things have happened that have just made me sort of, you know, drop my jaw, and I can't, you know, it's horrible and fantastic at the same time.
Well, you know, aside from the big events that they've done, it's some of the little stuff that they've done that's been, like, the most amazing to me. You know, we're in late 1967, and Megan gives Don, you know, the Beatles revolver, and she, you know, she says, play track, whatever, and it's, you know, Tomorrow Never Knows, and Don, you know, stops playing the song. It doesn't click with him, and, you know, mm-hmm. that was right at the beginning of the LSD experimentation. You had Roger taking, you know, dropping acid.
Right.
And the show never does anything in like a sensationalistic way. It's always so quietly understated, even
yet unconventional.
Yeah, well, yeah, like this last episode, I
don't want to spoil it. Yeah,
you were avoiding spoilers, so will I. The second to last episode of season 5, even the way they played that scene, everything was so stark mm-hmm. that it was just a very emotional scene. That show just kicks my butt, and it's so weird because, you know, it's on right after Game of Thrones. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm all fired up from Game of Thrones, and then I turn on Mad Men, and I get even worse.
I've started to separate the two now because I have a hard time going from one to the other, and I love them both, you know, but it's like I can't take that much of a transition from, you know, from one to the other. I need a little time in between. So I've started watching Game of Thrones on Sunday night, and then I wait till Monday to go and back and watch Mad Men.
Well, okay, if you just look at it like this, that like Joffrey Baratheon and Pete Campbell are birds of a feather, you can just flow from one show right into the other one.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one's worse. Pete is a dirtbag. God.
Earlier in the season, I was starting to root for him, and then it was just like the last few weeks, I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
You got douchier.
You have no shame, no morals. You are just, oh, so bad.
Ken Cosgrove's the only one that's not going to hell at this point.
Cosgrove is like the you know, the shining knight. But then if you play L.A. Noire, the video game, he's, you know, he's sort of a crooked cop. Not crooked, but he's not exactly, you know, the nicest.
I got a lot of good TV coming to me. I don't watch either one of those shows.
Oh, goodness.
I'm sorry.
DVD. Oh, yeah, you spoiled everything. And I LSD, they're dropping it.
Shit, I'm sorry. Yeah, I did say that. I'm sorry.
Ah, he'll be fine. He won't even remember it.
I don't remember it now.
I feel bad that I blew that. Anyway, I watched.
I don't even know who the characters are. It's fine.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I don't think that's a big, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that big a thing. I mean, it's interesting, but by the time you get to that, if you haven't watched Mad Men, by the time you get to that point, it's not going to matter.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's not a huge spoiler.
But, you know, it is fascinating to look at, you know, to bring it around to what we were talking about, how serialized fiction is handled with, you know, these TV shows. Or, you know, you can obviously see something like Aaron Sorkin's work influencing Brian Bendis and stuff like that. So it's fascinating to look at how serialized fiction works in different mediums. And, you know, how you can maybe take some lessons learned from some of these TV shows and bring them over to comics. Good enough to you.
be honest, I don't know that we necessarily need to. I mean, I have something that I've read if you guys are interested at all, but otherwise, I don't know if you guys
lay it on.
What did you read?
Well, talking about sort of creator-owned stuff and getting your own things published, I've really sort of stepped back a lot in the last year or so from mainstream comics, and mostly nowadays I almost make an effort to just read non-superhero books. And not because I don't enjoy superhero books necessarily, but I don't know when to stop. It's like a problem. It's a bit of a problem. Like, I'll go, hey, I'll check out Wolverine.
Sal's in the bathroom again. Wolverine
might be good this week or this month, and then all of a sudden it'll be like, well, let's try, the Avengers, and then we'll try Hulk, and then it's like Batman looks pretty cool, and then before I know it, I'm reading a bunch of books that
are mainlining Superman.
Yeah, exactly. No, but there, it's like I think I have a hard time distinguishing between a good superhero book and a bad one sometimes, because I'm blinded by the costumes and the characters that I really enjoy and grew up with and love. So
does this hold true for independent Image Comics superhero books? Which honestly, I don't think there's a whole lot of them.
Yeah, there's not very many of them, so I don't. I mean, other than Invincible.
But would that happen if you were to pick up a couple of good ones?
No, I don't think that would happen because I don't have a love of those characters, so I'm not going to be blinded by, some sort of love of Invincible necessarily. But anyway, to get back to what I was trying to say is that I've been really concentrating on stuff outside of superhero books, and picking up smaller, more interesting things. And one of the books that I read recently that I really enjoyed was Who is Jake Ellis by Nathan Edmondson and a dude whose name I can't pronounce. It's Tansy Zanjic.
Zanjic.
I think. He goes by Tozo, thank God. It's basically a sort of espionage thriller mystery. And I don't want to give a whole lot away about it, but it's about a guy who is on the run from this sort of secret organization, government organization. He's not sure who they are, what they're after, but he is being helped by what appears to be the ghost of a secret agent that's...
I didn't interpret it that way when I read it. I just thought it was like his conscience or some.
Well, it's ambiguous. I mean, they don't. And I don't want to necessarily spoil it either. But
the whole first issue is meant to entice and make you. Who is this guy that only he sees?
Yeah,
it's a brilliant first issue because you see a scene once. And you revisit the scene the second time with an added dimension, a different perspective, and you completely reread it absolutely differently, and it just sucked me right in.
Yeah. Strong entrance with that
great
book.
Hook. Yeah, and just terrific art that keeps everything moving. No, that's a fantastic book.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I know I've read and heard other people talking about the ending. They weren't necessarily crazy about how it ended or what it, necessarily gave you as an ending, which I wasn't, I didn't have a problem with necessarily. I think part of the problem is as you're reading it, you're sitting here trying to figure out the mystery of who is this guy? Who is Jake Ellis? I mean, the title of the book, and that's, the whole thing is that when you get to the end and you sort of find out who Jake Ellis is, it maybe is a bit of a letdown because your imagination has taken you somewhere else, but I think that's a credit to the book. You know, I mean,
I wasn't let down with who he was. I thought it was a good ending. I don't know. I heard a lot of those complaints too. I thought that it tied off rather nicely, and it may have been slightly anticlimactic, but I mean, the guy, I think it ended with him still, you know, he's still going to be chased.
Yeah, and not necessarily.
I think that story, you know, just a clear assumption here, is probably was born out of concept, you know. I've got this story where there's this guy who he has this other guy that can guide him around, and you know, I guess maybe Edmondson crafted a story rather quickly, or you know, about it. But I thought it was really good. I mean, and this book, let's face it, it made the artist. I'm not even going to attempt his name.
Tozo.
I mean, he's been credited as being a cinematic artist, and he went on to do one of Mignola's books, a Lobster Johnson book. So
yeah, he did the Lobster Johnson miniseries. I think, you know, he has a very Alex Tothian sort of
very simple.
Black and white, you know, lots of shadows and relief kind of work to it, but I tried
to draw simple like that, just looking at his art, and you know, you look at it and immediately you think, oh, this looks so easy to do. Maybe I should adopt a style similar to this, but you quickly learn that, you know, there has to be something under, you know, this structure, this building of the scene before you, those simple, real quick gestural line arts are.
I think he definitely has, you know.
He's really good.
It's almost like he takes away from the, you know, the more complex work that's underneath it, and then he just sort of erases what he doesn't think
subtractive.
Is there. Yeah. But I was always amazed by, to me, like the facial expressions that he was able to get from really very few lines in some of this stuff, and the differences in faces, you know, like the how people looked so different from one another, and a lot of times with really, you know, not a whole lot of line work at all.
Yeah, he's not suffering from the audience having the inability to tell who's who, that's for sure.
But I really liked it. And Nathan Edmondson, you know, we had talked about this off mic a little bit about how he's sort of, I don't know anything about the guy other than, you know, this book and the other work that he's putting out. You're reading
The Activity,
which is him and
Mitch Garrett's.
Yeah.
Comic Twart's very own.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying that book, and Mitch is doing a bang-up job. You know, and then going back to what we were saying about creator-owned and having your own books out, and you look at Nathan Edmondson and the model that he's going under, I mean, it's almost like he's found a very productive place to be, and just, you know, enlists these artists to do these books of his. I mean, I read the Light, and he had Britt Veldell on it, and, you know, of Surrogates fame, and that book, I enjoyed it. It was a kind of a thriller type survivalist book where unnatural light or you know, light from light bulbs will kill you. I don't know how he came up with that story, but it was pretty enjoyable. But he's just so prolific. He's got stuff out like three at a time, you know? I mean, how do you do that? How can I be him is what I want to know. Discuss.
We're going to drop something in there, right?
Am I still on?
Sorry. You know what? Sorry. I was talking that entire time. I accidentally hit the mute button on my microphone. So I was wondering why you guys weren't responding. I said, quit wasting time talking to us. That's your first step into becoming Nathan Edmondson.
So you're saying just sit down and work?
I don't know. I mean, it's always hard to tell. Like, you sit there and go, well, this guy's so prolific, but who knows how long he had been working on, like, five books that just happened to come out all at the same time. I mean, I don't
know. Right.
I don't know, you know. He could.
Well, he did something. Didn't he do something for one of the big two?
Yeah, wasn't he writing the Grifter relaunch for the new 52?
That's it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
he
you're
did
right.
That.
And then he did. Well, let's look at his bibliography. He started on Pop Gun Volume 3. He did a story in that, and then he did a book called Olympus, which I have not read, but I've heard good things about.
I've heard that. Yeah.
That was an Image book. Then he did The Light. Then he did Who Was Jake Ellis? Grifter, The Activity, and now he's got something with Nick Klein called Dancer. All I want to know is, how's this dude getting, like, some of the best artists?
You know what? We didn't even talk about Dancer. Dancer is awesome. That's like, what, it's two issues in, or one issue in? I read, that's a killer book right there.
I haven't read it, but it's Nick Klein, and Nick Klein is awesome.
Yeah, that's why I'm so stoked about it. Story, I'm sure, is going to be, you know, good. Edmondson's pretty solid, but the art on it is...
How's he getting these? Really good. He seems to have a talent for getting really good artists. So either he has money, and he's like,
he's got name power too. Apparently,
yeah. I don't know. I don't know where this guy came from. We
I
need
don't
to
know,
find
man.
Out.
Nathan, look into it.
Nathan Edmondson, if you're listening, come on my show and tell us your secrets of success, so we can sort of siphon them from you like vampires.
Yep.
Like umpires, what?
Like vampires.
Oh, okay.
I can't think of another writer that has a a setup kind of like him. I mean, it used to be the model was Mike Mignola, because, you know, he had the Mignola verse, which right now, you know, Mike Mignola's always already come into his own, but now, I mean, he's really prolific with, and you know, he got Tozo on that one book, and there was a another Abe Sapien book that came out, and he's almost becoming the big three, in my opinion.
Oh, well, third. I mean, in terms of, like, a family of books, I'm sorry, those are the best books on the stands right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, there's not an – I don't – there. He's up there by himself with that.
I mean, yeah, the whole Mignola universe is just, you know, I love the process of how, you know, he just sort of, there's no set way he releases things. Like, this story is going to be five issues. This one's going to be seven. This one's going to be
And you know what? I think that takes the pressure off. And, you know, when I was doing those faux covers for Hit on my blog, I mean, that's kind of what I was thinking, you know, three issues of whatever, you know, and mystery, and then, you know, take your time, come up with the next two-issue run of whatever little adventure.
Well, and you look at, like, BPRD, I personally think that there hasn't been a bad BPRD story.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, they're all good. Every single one, because they serve the story, and it's like, we're gonna take the time to craft a good story every time, and that's
not only that, it's a singular vision. I mean, other than Scott Alley, I think Mignola's the only writer, and you know,
no, John Arcudi is scripting BPRD.
Well, it's still limited.
Yeah,
you know, Marvel and DC, you know, I've cashed out long ago on, you know, reading I mean, you jump in with whatever writer, take his story, but you don't. I mean, how could there be any real continuity with the changing of the guard as it is? But.
Well, and you know, and it's just like I always sort of laugh when there'll be some book that's marginally popular and you know, but it's not successful enough at Marvel or DC that gets canceled after, you know, 18 issues or something. And it's like, you know, you always say, oh, it was so good. Why did it have to get canceled? It's like, well, maybe it just, that's all it really needed was 18 issues. Do we need, you know, 75 issues of every B character that comes out or every, you know, secondary group of superheroes? Yeah. You know, it's like, maybe they would be better stories if they didn't try and, you know, keep it published, you know, month after month after month, you know, just keep pumping them out. How about, you know, taking more time to create? But that's not their business model. That's not, you know.
Well, maybe, you know, Mignola's kind of learned from that, and that's why he, you know, does things the way he does. He puts them out.
Well, and to be completely self-serving and serve my own point earlier, you know, if Mike Mignola was under the same kind of situation work-wise in comics today that there is today, we wouldn't have gotten Hellboy if he hadn't been able to take the leap and do creator-owned stuff, because you know, creator-owned material was lucrative enough at the time that everybody was making the jump. And you know, most of my favorite comics are the work of a writer artist. And I guess that's why I get so bummed out when, you know, when we see various writers being able to launch half a dozen books while they're doing one or two Marvel books. And, you know, you don't get to see, you know, a Butch Geist creator owned book or Steve Epting or Michael Lark or any of that, you know, it just bums me out. Who knows? Maybe one of those guys has, you know, the next Hellboy.
Let me wrap up here real quickly. Thank you both gentlemen for joining me on this Skype episode of Around Comics. It was fun. I had a good time. I'm glad that we got together and talked about all sorts of different things. And, you know, Steve, you know my position on one thing to be true is that, I hope nothing but the best for you, my friend. You are a good man. And a friend, and I hope you just kill it with your new series and with Athena Voltaire from Dark Horse, and you know, just all the. I hope you do make $1 million. So,
well, thank you, and I'm looking forward to reading, you know, your top secret project. And no, I'm not being facetious, and I'm looking forward to getting a copy of Hit and reading it as well. So I'm flattered to be in the company of
great.
Other people who want to go out and do this stuff and are so passionate about it. So you guys rock.
We try. And Braxton, thank you, sir. I'm sure this will not be the last time you're on. I'm going to drag you.
No, anytime.
On. Yes, you will.
I'm available.
Very, very. I'm not doing anything. I have nothing going on. That's
that's me, man.
That's how I like it.
I'm over here. Just, you know, pick me up, dust me off, show me the mic.
All right. Well, thanks again, everyone, for listening to Around Comics. Appreciate it. Hopefully this will be a bit more of a regular thing, and hopefully we'll also get Chris and Tom on soon. Once again, thanks to our sponsor, DCB Service, Discount Comic Book Service. You can find them at DCBService.com. Go there and save lots of money on your comics. And that's a wrap. That's it. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Now if your mind lies in the devil's workshop, and evil doing's your thrill, and trouble and mischief is all you live for, you know done well, and that you go to hell, that you go to hell. So you're living high and mighty, rich off the fat of the land. Just don't dispose of your natural soul, because you know done well that you'll go to hell.